Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. Morning, Francis.
Good morning, Mark.
Que pasta.
Que pasta. No pasta this morning. I'm going the low-carb route.
You are not.
You Italian. How's things this morning?
Things are good. Things are good. Drinking some good wines.
We have on the show later today, we have coming back for a reappearance. We had him earlier in the week, and he was so interesting, we asked him to come back. We have Sam Gugino. Sam Gugino was a syndicated columnist. He's a wine columnist for the Scar Aficionado for Wine Spectator magazine. He contributes to the New York Times. He's written a bunch of books, and he has a great website called samcooks.com. And he's going to come talk to us about coffee and a lot of the things that we're concerned about. He's really in the know, one of the most intelligent guys that I know writing about food today. So that's a little bit later. But I read in the Times something about a producer that I've been fascinated with for a while now.
Really? In Italy?
In Italy, yeah. And I know we talked about this a little before the show. There is a guy named Josco Gravener who is making wine in the north of Italy, in Alpine Italy. And he's in the Friuli region, mm-hmm. an inner appellation of the Friuli region called the Venezia Giulia region in northeastern Italy. And he is making wine in a very... in a very old way. A lot of what we talk about, a lot of the artisans we talk about, embrace old ways, embrace technology to make sure things are clean, mm-hmm. but use old methods. Now, this guy is making wine in amphora. He's making wine in amphora. Now, what an amphora is...
Tell us.
Actually, amphora were the way that all wine was shipped and stored for many years, and it was one of the greatest impediments to shipping wine in the trade in wine, was it was very expensive to ship it. It's basically a ceramic something. The wine amphoras, Roman wine amphoras, were generally about to shoulder height, mm-hmm. and it looked like a big vase, you know, or a vase if you're from Princeton. But it looked like a vase about as tall as your shoulder, and you would fill it with wine, and then it had a cap on it, and that's how you would store your wine. That's how you would send your wine abroad to ships. They'd be lashed in the ships.
This guy, Gravener, seals his wine also with beeswax.
Well, the thing is, throwback. One of the things that happened was that with the wine trade internationally, it came about with the invention of the bottle, the mm-hmm. glass bottle, which was a 750-milliliter glass bottle. A case of these, obviously, is much more stable than a 25-gallon or 45-gallon ceramic amphora. Which,
yeah, you don't want to break that.
Yeah, that's a lot of damage.
That'd be a bummer.
One broken bottle, not so bad. You know, one broken amphora on the galley, and you got to, you know, it's worth two slaves. You know what I mean? But
I don't know.
I made that up. Two cubits and a slave. But I have. But no one's made wine in amphoras. I don't know, in 1,000 years.
Yeah, long.
Josco Gravener.
Actually, there are some people in Russia making wine in amphoras still, but nobody's making it commercially.
Well, Josco Gravener is making it commercially. He has mm-hmm. gone back to that what's historically correct for the region, the way wine was made many years ago. And what he does is he takes this large ceramic amphora, and he stores it by burying it in the ground.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre.
To hold the temperature. And what he does to keep it somewhat sealed is he coats the amphora, as you mentioned earlier, Mark, mm-hmm. in beeswax. How bizarre!
It's really bizarre.
Is that? And I'm tempted to think, I don't know how I feel when I read about this, you know, a year ago, and I thought, oh well, let's see, you know, is it a gimmick?
Right. You know that some of the amphora that he's using are 3,500 liters.
That's incredible.
These amphora that he's burying in the ground.
So think about the 2-liter bottle of Coke in the supermarket and multiply it by 1,700.
By 1750, right? These are large vessels, ceramic vessels.
And
But if the wine stunk, we wouldn't be talking about it, okay?
And what happened
was... That's
really
the bottom line.
Mark and I, after looking at this for a long time, have finally taken delivery on a couple of bottles of his white.
Mm-hmm.
He really likes old stuff. An old yep. grape variety called Ribolla.
Yeah, I've only had one. I had one Ribolla prior to Gravener's.
From Eastern Europe.
Was from Slovenia.
Yeah.
And that's the only other Ribolla I had ever tried. And I liked it. It was very interesting, very, very delicious kind of floral notes to it, and floral grape. But the Ribolla we had from Gravener.
It's absolutely incredible. Now, it
blew my doors off.
This is a public service announcement from WCTC. You've entered the realm of wine geekdom, everyone. This is a wine geek alert.
You have arrived.
This is an actual wine geek emergency. We're talking about Ribolla being made in amphora. Or M4A, which is the plural of M4A.
Oh, you don't know that.
I do, actually. What a dork. I told you you're in the dork zone. Wow. But this wine is absolutely incredible. Now, it retails at about $125 a bottle.
Yeah, big time. Big time dollars here.
And that's a lot. They ship it in, and it actually came out being more expensive than I thought it was going to be, because I bought it based on the case price.
Right.
And the case is usually 12 bottles. They ship me a 9-bottle case. I'm like, hey!
He's kind of a nonconformist, Jasko Gravner.
All I have to say is this wine is absolutely incredible. We have it on the listed stage left now, but I mean, it's crazy expensive. It's like, you know, save your pennies.
He makes two whites. He makes the Ribolla, which we alluded to a couple minutes ago. Makes another wine called a Breg, which is a blend of a bunch of different white varietals.
But you're talking about using a 5,000-year-old method for making wine. And one of the reasons it's so expensive is because this is very expensive method of making wine. Mm-hmm. Plus, no one's done it. Plus, he's taken a huge risk. But let me tell you, the wines are unlike any wine I've ever had, we have a lot of wine, you and I.
I mean, this guy's kind of a little bizarre, too, but I do like some of the things he says. Let me quote an article from the Times a couple weeks ago. It's a technique that requires exquisite care in the vineyard. You can't correct the wine once it's in the M4A, Mr. Grobner said. Whatever is good or bad will be amplified. Kind of like your friends when they're drunk. same principle.
Same personality, just turned up a little bit.
Yeah, turn up the volume.
It's interesting. Now, this is obviously not something that has relevance to a lot of people. This is obviously something that even for us would be a once in a... I mean, you know, I don't plan on opening another bottle of that anytime soon because I don't generally spend, you know, $125 on bottles.
Liar. You're just a big fat liar.
Okay, I do. But I'm trying to be humble. But, you know...
But most of you don't.
I'd sell my car in order to drink good wine.
You don't have the same maladies that my partner suffers from.
But I have to say, this is a once-in-a-lifetime sort of taste.
It really is.
The flavor profile is very unique.
Like nothing I've ever had before.
And it makes you think what wine... And honestly, it's an old grape variety. There's no reason to think that this isn't what wine tasted like.
Right.
2,000 years ago.
But the other thing I really like about Grobner is there's really no concern for what the wine looks like.
Right.
The wines are cloudy. The wines are very yellowish. They're not what you would expect when drinking a contemporary white wine. And Grobner seems to feel that it doesn't matter at all what they look like. Actually, a quote from the same article that I'm quoting before. Color of wine is like the color of a man, he said. What matters is what's underneath.
That's so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. but truly, we get so hung up on a wine being crystal clear and pristine and perfect all the time that I think people sometimes never get to what's beyond that, what's past that, which is why you're drinking a wine, is because of what it tastes like or the foods that it goes with.
And I think it's funny that in a world that's heading towards screw caps, you have Jasko Gravner going back 5,000 years for amphoras. And I also want to...
He's going the other way.
And when we say the wine is very expensive, that does not mean that Jasko Gravner is very rich. He's not. It's just that this is a labor of love in what he wants to do. We'll be back in a moment or two, and we're going to be talking with Sam Gugino, who has samcooks.com, who is a columnist for the Wine Spectator magazine, a contributor to Cigar Aficionado and Woman's Day. He's contributed to the New York Times and written a bunch of books. And he's one of the most intelligent guys we know. We're going to talk to him about coffee. We're going to finish our discussion about coffee that we began earlier in the week and talk to him about farming and the state of food in general in America. Can't think of a better way to spend 45 minutes. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, The Times, 1115. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're here with our very special guest today, Sam Gugino. Sam is a food columnist for the Wine Spectator magazine, a contributor to Cigar Aficionado and Women's Day, as well as a contributor to the New York Times. He's been nominated for a James Beard Journalism Award, author of books like Cooking to Beat the Clock and Eat Fresh, Stay Healthy, and now he publishes the fabulous foodie newsletter and website, which you can find at www.samcooks.com, or you can go to our website later, which is restaurantguys.com, and we'll link you there. But more importantly, right now, just relax and listen to him because he's right here. Hi, Sam.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Sam. That's an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah. I abridged it. There's stuff I left out.
I wish I got paid by the word.
You do, don't you, sometimes? Not in
yeah,
my words, but
not
your
a
words.
Whole lot,
Well, Sam, you are our first holdover guest. We actually had such fun talking to you earlier in the week that we invited you back because there's so much information, and we were pretty much in that show talking about one topic, which is coffee.
Yeah, we only got halfway through our notes.
Oh, my God.
It's a big topic. Yeah.
Well, just so everyone knows what prompted this, is I've been getting Sam's newsletter for years, and I really like it, and we've run into each other at tastings and the like, and I got this one article that you did. It was a tome on coffee from production to you visited the fincas, you visited the farms in Central America, and you talked about the economics of it, and you talked about the flavors of it, and what makes great coffee, and right down to what kind of coffee maker you should buy and how you should make it.
Good
at
news,
home.
Sam. You're halfway done with the book.
Yeah, exactly. So where we left off, though, and what we didn't really touch on, was you had a section in this great article on the history of coffee.
Right.
Can you talk to us about the history of coffee? Because
sure.
here I'm thinking, who figured out that taking a fruit that looks like a cherry, throwing away the fruit, taking the beans, processing it, roasting it, grinding it, making a very bitter black beverage would become the most popular beverage in the world? How do we get from here to there?
Well, first I want to know the first guy who ate the artichoke.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
That must have taken some doing. Anyway,
I want to know who ate the first egg, Sam.
A lot of great stories out there.
Yeah, right? Really, really.
Food findings.
But you know about coffee, so let's find out how it happened.
Sure. With regard to coffee, you know, as with so many foods, it sort of happened by happenstance, and the traditional story may or may not be apocryphal, and that was that some goat herder was noticing that his goats were jumping around like crazy, very friskier than normal, and apparently he found out they were eating these berries from this plant, which happened to be the coffee plant. This was probably in Ethiopia, people think, but it's now Ethiopia anyway. And at some point he realized that he could stay awake and watch his goats at night by eating this stuff too, and one thing led to another. Well, the interesting thing is that for centuries, the coffee bean was not brewed as a beverage.
It was a fruit?
It was either eaten as a fruit or the beans were somehow mixed in with other things.
Huh.
And eaten almost like a snack.
Mm-hmm. Now, the bean, the coffee bean, is basically the pit of the coffee.
Right, it's the pit of this fruit, which people in the business call a cherry. Mm-hmm. And it looks, when it's ripe, it's bright red. It's a more oval than a cherry would be. I liken it more like to a large cranberry. When that fruit is taken off in a pulping machine, then you get the pit or the seed or the bean, and then that bean is processed in various ways that we talked about yesterday.
Where do we know that people first started to process coffee to make the bitter beverage that we know, that's something like what we know today?
Well, it was probably somewhere in the Arabian Peninsula, maybe Yemen, places like that.
And then it became pretty important to the history of coffee is tied in the history of the world because it's so important to international economies. Can you speak to us a little about the role it's played in the rise and fall of empires?
It's been a commodity for a long time.
It's been a commodity for a long time. It's the second largest traded commodity in the world after oil. Economies tend to go up and down with the price of coffee, not quite as dramatically as oil, because even though it's an important beverage, it doesn't necessarily make the world go round like oil does.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, yes. But it did involve a lot of colonialization. The Dutch, for example, took coffee plants to Java, and that was part of their colonization of Java and Sumatra and Indonesia. Of course, then it was brought to the Americas. What's interesting is that the coffee plant really takes well to a lot of places in the equatorial part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And very often that coffee plant was part of the kind of imperialist domination of these various areas of the world.
Uh-huh.
Whether it was in South America, Central America, Africa, or Indonesia. And then coffee became very important traded commodity worldwide. And it took a while for coffee, the drink, to get going. I mean, it really wasn't until, about the 18th century that coffee really started to catch on. And coffee was allegedly discovered in the 6th century. So that's a long time before coffee, the beverage, really started to catch on.
Is that when coffee sort of overtook tea?
Well, yeah, the coffee houses became very popular places France and in England in the 18th century.
That's happening again, Sam.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty wild. Hey,
so I've heard.
Let me just tell everyone that we're talking with Sam Gugino, who is a food columnist for Wine Spectator magazine, New York Times author et al. About coffee. And we'll be talking more with him about coffee and the history of the world and other fine things about food and wine in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125. Market Francis. We're talking to Sam Gugino, who's an expert on many things having to do with food and wine, not least among them coffee. Sam, we were talking a lot about, a moment ago, the history of coffee and the role it's played in the economies and the rise and fall of empires in the world. I am fascinated by how ritualistic coffee drinking is and how it varies from culture to culture.
But yet it seems that most cultures do indeed have coffee in their culture.
What are your observations on how those things arose? My example is the first time I was in Vienna, I ordered coffee, and that's Vienna's a famous coffee city.
Right.
And they served it with a glass of water. And I thought, they always serve, and I found out that in Austria, whenever they serve coffee, they serve you a glass of water so that you can dilute the coffee if you want, or you can drink it with the coffee. And I thought that was very, very bizarre, you know?
It's not uncommon, for example, with espresso drinks. For example, there are different kinds of espresso drinks where you can have a long pull or a short pull, and water added to it. A ristretto has more hot water added to it. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I tell people to do when they're making any kind of coffee is always err on the strong side.
Right.
You could always weaken it by a little hot water, but
right.
You can't make it stronger once you've made it.
You know what's funny is my sister is notorious for making very strong coffee, and my sister and I drink very strong coffee, and my parents, I mean, we're Irish, Sam, we drink very weak coffee historically.
Yeah.
But Francine's coffee would sometimes be very bitter.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is, if you put in a lot of lousy coffee, what you're going to get is bitterness. But what people may not realize is that when you use really good coffee, if you made it a little too strong for you, you can dilute it with water.
It doesn't get more bitter, it gets more intense.
Exactly.
One note, too, is that bitter coffee can also be a sign of over-extraction. Now, one of the coffee makers that's very popular these days is the French press pot.
Yes.
And what happens with some people is they'll just press the plunger down and then leave the coffee in the pot. What happens is the bottom of those grounds is still extracting into the water.
Gotta pour that coffee off.
Your first cup of coffee is good, and then your third cup of coffee is a little strong there.
Yeah, they actually have a press pot now that you can buy that's in a thermos.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And with the idea that you don't have to pour the stuff into a thermos to keep it hot, because a normal press pot does not keep the coffee hot.
I do love coffee from press pots, though, Sam.
I'm not knocking the press pot, but my point is, once you use the press pot, you need to pour it right away either into your coffee cup or into a thermos.
Right. We'll be back in a moment. Central Jersey, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450, time is 11:30. Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and reach us through our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. Speaking of the inside track and the finer things in life, we are talking with Sam Gugino, who's a food columnist for the Wine Spectator magazine, a contributor to Cigar Aficionado and Women's Day, as well as the New York Times. He's been nominated nominated for a James Beard Journalism Award, author of books like Cooking to Beat the Clock. All right, I'm running out of energy. I can't go any further. He's got a website, which is www.samcooks.com, and a great newsletter. We'll link that up later on our site, and you can find out more directly from Sam. But we're talking with Sam about coffee. Can we talk some more about coffee, Sam?
Sure. Before we do, I want to mention one thing, and that is that newsletter that you mentioned so nicely is an online newsletter, and it's free, and you can sign up for it on the website.
And I'll be honest, as I said, we had Sam on the show earlier. I steal ideas from you, Sam, all the time. That newsletter is really great, and what's nice about it is it's very intelligent and in-depth. You know.
Thank you.
Sam, we were just talking about French press for a way of making coffee. And actually, French press is my favorite way of making coffee for myself. Make it, pour it off, and drink it. How do you generally like to make your coffee?
I make it in a French press. I have individual French press pots for just myself because my wife doesn't drink coffee in the morning. She may have it later on in the day. So I have these individual pots. So I make it. And the nice thing about the individual press pots is that the coffee, there's nothing better than coffee, one cup brewed at a time. You know, coffee, even if it sits for 10 minutes, it doesn't taste the same as it does when it first comes out of the pot.
I love the French press is that little crema you get on top of your cup of coffee is almost as if it were an espresso.
Exactly. The crema, for people who don't know, is what you get in an espresso from the pressure, and it's that little froth on top, and you know a good espresso when you do get a nice crema. And unfortunately, most espressos you get in many places do not have it.
Yeah.
It's one of the sad things.
Well, you know, one of the cultural differences in coffee is that, you know, I have a friend who's Turkish, and we have Turkish coffee with her, and Turkish and Greek coffee, you have the grinds in, they're very finely ground like a powder, and then the grinds settle to the bottom of the cup. How do you feel about making coffee in that way?
Well, I'm a big fan of that. I mean, the Middle Eastern Turkish tradition is to take the fine grinds, boil them, and there's a tendency to boil a little too much for my taste, and then to pour it out, and then you have to deal with the grounds. Hopefully they'll be at the bottom, but inevitably you're drinking a cup of coffee, and you know you're at the grounds when they start hitting your lips.
Right, it's
kind of like drinking a glass of wine with sediment in it.
Right, exactly. The other thing that the Turks and the Middle Easterns do is they put a lot of sugar in the coffee,
which
I am not a big fan of.
Actually, why don't you talk to us about cream and sugar and stuff in coffee?
Sure. There's an interesting theory, and there's some debate as to how true it is, but that people in the northern parts of Europe or in the northern climes tend more often to drink coffee with milk, whereas people in warmer areas in the Mediterranean, in the Middle East, North Africa tend not to drink it with milk. And there is some feeling that there has something to do with milk intolerance as being a reason. And it may also be just custom. That's possible, too. But you will notice that if you're traveling in Morocco, in Egypt, in the Middle East, and in southern parts of Europe, in Greece and Italy and so forth, people do not put milk in their coffee.
Yeah, I would think it would be difficult to keep milk fresh in those climates.
That's another reason, too.
You know, actually, we had on the show a couple of weeks ago, we had a very interesting guy named Stephen Witherly, who's a PhD, he's a nutrition expert, and he's also an expert in flavor and taste. And he was talking about how whether you like cream in your coffee or you like your coffee black has to do a lot with how your taste buds are set up and whether you're a super taster, an average taster, or, you know, you have fewer taste buds than most. And how, you know, we talked a lot about how bitterness is sort of an adult, something you acquire taste for as an adult. And I thought that was, I think it's very fascinating. And I will tell you that I've pissed off some ex-girlfriends because I don't drink my coffee the same way all the time. And most people, don't you find that most people drink their coffee the same way? It's like a sugar and two creams. I like it black. I like it with a little cream and sugar, a little cafe con leche.
Francis, just another way that you are different than the rest of America.
Well, when I was in Central America for the story, I drank it black almost all the time just because that's the way everybody else was drinking it there. And I also wanted to get the full, tell you an interesting story here about Coles to Newcastle. David Dallas and Jim Munson, who are the two people I went to Central America with, who are the principals in Dallas Coffee in Queens, because there isn't a coffee culture in these countries, which is interesting, they do not drink good coffee in those countries.
Really?
So they took the coffee that was sent up to them from these coffee plantations and roasted it and brought it back down with their own coffee pots.
Really?
Yes.
You know, it's funny. We knew a guy who was he took a wine class that Mark and I taught many years ago, and he was in the back of the class. And you know, we teach consumer wine classes very often. And this guy, I mean, he was getting everything right. I mean, he didn't know a lot about the references to wine and the culture of wine and the frame of reference.
Right, but he was picking things out that amateurs never pick out.
This guy had a nose on him, and he had a photographic memory. And I asked him what he did for a living, and he purchased coffee for a living.
Professional coffee tasting.
And he took me to his office and taught us how to cup coffee, to taste it. It's a little different than how you taste wine.
Right.
But you're looking for the same thing. You're looking for what it smells like and what it tastes like. And he had this little roaster, and he said, yeah, when we go buy green beans, we go down, we buy the green beans, I roast them on the spot. I'll pick out samples from the various lots of coffee. I'll roast them on the spot and make them before we'll make a bid on that coffee. And I think that's really fascinating. Did you see that kind of stuff when you were down there?
As a matter of fact, we visited a very large coffee, the second largest coffee exporter in the world, and they were located in Nicaragua.
Uh-huh.
And there were just piles and piles and piles of these green coffees, mm-hmm. and they were constantly tasting. And what's interesting, mass-produced coffee is a lot like Budweiser in the sense that the people who do it really know their stuff.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Anybody will tell you that the brewers at Budweiser know their stuff cold.
Right.
They could make the best beer in the world if they wanted to.
But there's less money in that.
They clearly choose not to, though.
They choose not to, and what they do is, and this is what the mass-produced coffee guys do, is they create these blends.
Right,
that give
homogenous
you a
blends, right.
Consistency of taste. That's the key. Make sure that it's not terrible, but it's a consistent taste, because the person who opens up their Folgers mountain-grown coffee wants it to taste the same this week as it did last week, whereas you and I, we'd like to have something different.
Right. Yeah. Almost be better. You know, we talk about this even with the cheeses. We had a cheese producer on a little while ago, and we talk about with cheeses. The cheese tastes different depending on what season it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And it should.
And on the high end, people are willing to accept that. But in the middle, the mass market stuff, they want the Velveeta to be Velveeta to be Velveeta.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we'll allow for, when you really get into it, you're like, oh, well, it's the spring milk and it's the fall. And you know that the product is going to be great because you trust the person you buy it from and the person who makes it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, having good food is about embracing the cycles of life, isn't
right.
it?
Right.
Isn't it?
And it's not having strawberries in January,
right.
and it's
right.
having tomatoes when they're in season coming up now.
You can have strawberries in January, but they should be strawberry preserves.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's so much about what we talk about. And you talk in your articles, you're not only talking about coffee, you're talking about farming, et cetera, and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And what would you say do you see your focus as in writing your newsletters and having your site? What is your mission, Sam?
Well, the first thing to do is two things. One is to entertain people, because you can give them all the information in the world, but if it's not written in a way that attracts or interests people, they're not going to read it. So you have to be entertaining, but you also don't want to be flip, too flip, too devil may care. You want to be serious.
Right.
So give good information, but do it with humor, do it with good storytelling, and so forth. And I enjoy doing that, so that's part of the fun for me.
Yeah. Do you cook at home?
All the time.
Yeah.
I'm always testing recipes either from my books, from my newsletter, or for the articles I write for Wine Spectator or other publications.
I think it's lucky to be a member of Sam Gugino's family. Just so everybody knows, we're talking with Sam Gugino, who is a noted author, has his own website called samcooks.com, and one of the best newsletters on food and wine that you're going to find anywhere. He also contributes to the New York Times, Wine Spectator Magazine, Cigar Aficionado. And we have been talking with him about coffee, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Sam about really good food, the cycles of life, and the things that we all need to keep in mind. And maybe we'll even get some tips from Sam on how to make a great cup of coffee. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we have renowned author and food writer Sam Gugino talking with us. And Sam, you were just talking to us a little bit about your philosophies on food and wine and what kind of motivates you to write your articles and books and things. Why don't we go a little bit into you know, the family farm and those types of things and how involved with those things you are.
Sure. Two things that I feel very strongly about in terms of wine and food, and that is, A, that we don't pay enough for our food.
Mm-hmm.
We have gotten used to the idea of this Walmartization of food where everything has to be really cheap. And if anybody's traveled anywhere else in the world, particularly in Europe, you know that people pay more money for certain things like chickens and beef,
right,
and so forth. But they also get good quality,
mm-hmm,
too. So I think people need to know that if you want quality, it comes at a price.
Yeah, the other thing that I think in the United States that we need to move away from is that you shop every week or week and a half.
Right.
That's the big difference I see it in the cultures as well.
I have an interesting statistic, and I have no idea why I know this. It was maybe we were talking about another story, but in 1965, the average American household spent 50% of their income on food.
Mm-hmm.
Today, they spend 10% of their income on food. Okay,
that's wrong.
So they. What do you mean? That's incorrect, or you
no,
mean
it's
that's?
No, it's sadly it's true.
I got the paper right here. Yeah, no, but the thing is, and what? So we need to have cheap food, and like you said, the Walmartization, Sam. It's like if you pay farmers good enough money, they can stay on their farm and raise, mm-hmm, a quality product. And you know what? You don't need 17 Big Macs, sir. Our kids are fat. They're twice as likely to be fat than they were 10 years ago. And I'm not talking about what they look like, but the health implications of that are terrible.
Sure.
We have an obesity epidemic because food is so cheap. I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, one of the problems there, too, Francis, is you have the farm subsidies. And we know for a fact that most of the farm subsidies are going to large agribusiness, and very, very few of the farm subsidies are going to the small family farmer.
Right, who was being driven out left and right.
But
there is hope. There is hope. I mean, we are seeing a renaissance of the small family farm. I was just interviewing somebody from Heritage Foods.
Oh, yeah.
If you know about those folks.
Yeah, we have on the show.
Oh, good. And they, you know, they're, for example, their chickens now cost something like $6 a pound. And people would say, oh, my God, $6 a pound. Well, you have to realize that you're just starting to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They said that their economy of scale is such that they really can't use a normal slaughterhouse until they get 10,000 chickens.
Right, right.
And right now they're in the hundreds rather than the thousands. And when they get to that point, and they can do that because more and more small family farms produce these chickens, other family farms will say, hey, yeah, I want to do it too.
Well, the key is the consumer, and the consumer's got to buy these products and look for these products.
Well, and
apparently that's happening. I mean, mm-hmm, the 3 or 4 years ago they did it with turkeys and they sold out,
sure,
and they've doubled essentially their production every year since then.
Well, Sam, I also have to say I think that it is about the consumers, but you have a vital role to play, and I think so do we.
Right. Yeah.
We're a linchpin of this. I mean,
right,
part of what we do, this is a little bit of religion in this, everybody, is we're trying to get the word out there that, and here's the word. The word is that to go out there, and I've said this before, I'm like a broken record, this is an area where it's not a chore to do what's good for the planet and what's best for the economy and what's best for local farmers. You can do good by doing well. If you go out and try and find the most humanely raised animals, the most organically raised produce, and somebody else goes out to find and all they're looking for is the best tasting product, you're both going to find yourself on the
same
farm.
You'll be in the
same place. You know?
Yeah, and the irony, too, is that cheap food, junk food, is not satisfying. People, mm-hmm, ask me, well, how could you be so thin being a food writer?
People don't ask me that, Sam.
And I say, I eat good food. And they say, well, yeah, but you eat all that good food. I said, yeah, and because I eat good food, I don't have to eat a lot of it.
Right.
You know, you can never be totally satisfied with snack wells.
Right.
That never satisfies. But if you have good food and you eat a regular meal like a human being, you sit around a table with your family and your friends instead of walking down the street, eating in your car,
mm-hmm, right,
that's not satisfying. That's not eating.
Right. And we eat to fulfill an emotional need as well. And I think that also when you talk about M&Ms and snack foods like that, those are designed to be addictive. Those are designed not to satisfy you but to make you come back for more. That bag of nachos is designed to make you eat the whole bag of nachos. That pint of Häagen-Dazs is designed to make you eat the pint of Häagen-Dazs. which I do occasionally. I really like it. All right, I got to get off my soapbox sometime. Hey, Sam, thank you so much for taking so much time out of your schedule to talk with us.
My pleasure, guys.
Sam, two great days of being a great guest. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be proud to link your website to ours, and everybody should go check out and hear more of what Sam has to say, because he has a lot to say, on www.samcooks.com. Very in-depth food coverage and very entertaining to read. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to have Bill Walker from Jersey Fresh, who's going to tell us what's available from the local farm stands, what you should be looking for this week.
There's some very, very interesting produce about to come into the marketplace. And New Jersey, we really got off to a very, very slow season this year. And Bill's going to tell us about some of the things that normally we might have had 2 or 3 weeks ago, but are starting to move into the marketplace now.
We know it's the last weekend for strawberries, and this is something we do every week. We have someone from Bill Walker from Jersey Fresh, which is from the New Jersey Department of Agriculture, to tell you what to look for and buy local, eat well, share it with your family, and take advice from us and Sam Gugino.
No, he gets it.
And he does get it, and his writing is really, really fascinating, both on his website and in the publications he contributes to. I hope we'll have to have him on the show again.
Yes, definitely. But let's come back with William Walker in just a minute.
Super. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:55.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal. I'm here with my partner, Francis Schott. And we have with us Bill Walker from Jersey Fresh to give us the weekly farm report. Bill, how are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you for touching base with me here.
What's going on in Jersey Farms? What can we look for in the local markets, man?
Well, the big thing, the overriding trend here is spring is over and summer's beginning.
Hot diggity dog.
Unfortunately, we're sweeping out the lettuces and some of the greens, and unfortunately, it's the end of strawberry season. If you haven't got out, do so today, but it's a great time of the year, beginning of blueberry season, starting this week in South Jersey.
I love blueberries. High in antioxidants, everyone.
Wonderful for you. And
blueberries are a superfood.
And certainly, we're second in the nation in the harvest of blueberries, and we do a big job with them, and we should have them for a month and a half, depending upon how the season goes.
And
we have folks in the Central Jersey area that grow them as well. So.
Hey, and if you go out for U-Pick Farms, we've heard from a couple of U-Pick Farms in Central Jersey, Indike Farms in Monroe, that this weekend is the last weekend that you'll be able to pick strawberries.
No question about it. And the more north you go, though, that you might have to travel a bit, but if you go north, you can find some North Jersey spots that still have some.
Great. And so it's blueberries, and then what comes after that, man? When do tomatoes come in?
Tomatoes, we're looking at the end of June, beginning of July for field-grown tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing collards now, basil, some of your greens that like the warmer, hotter weather. You'll start to see them, mint and all these sorts of other herbs and things coming in.
Right. For those of you who planted herbs when we did the show on it a few weeks ago, what you should see is those herbs should have doubled and tripled in size now. Your tomato plants should just be starting to bear a little bit of fruit.
I'm just so excited whenever I hear this stuff about summer. I mean, I'm just giddy over all the stuff that's coming in the summer. It makes me want to run barefoot through the field, you know, every time I talk to you, Bill.
Well, it should. And you know, I tell people just go out in the back garden and start filling up with what you got and just start making something and throw it all in there. It's all good.
Extraordinary. Right. Thanks for calling us, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
My pleasure, gentlemen. Have a good day now.
Take care,
sure,
man.
Take care now. All right, bye-bye.
That's Bill Walker from the New Jersey Department of Agriculture, Jersey Fresh, telling us about what we have to look forward to in the local farm markets. Buy local, eat well, and blueberries will keep you from getting cancer. Isn't that true, Mark?
That is true. They're superfood, super high in antioxidants.
And they're super delicious. Here's a tip for blueberries. When you're using blueberries, if you make your blueberry pie, if you use some cooked blueberries and some fresh blueberries, you will retain the snap. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 12 noon.